Hello, I'm Tommy Wasserman, and I'm professor of the New Testament at Örebro School of Theology in Sweden.
Dr. Tommy Wasserman, welcome to the Stone Chapel.
Thank you.
It's great to have you here at the Linear Theological Library. What are your impressions of the place so far?
It's a bit overwhelming, to say the least. But
is that a bad?
I actually heard a presentation you had last year, and you showed some images, but it's not like seeing the place. So it's quite impressive and a bit overwhelming. Construction is going on, so it will be even larger and more overwhelming, I guess.
And overwhelming when it comes, but we hope you'll come back and study with us and speak
with delighted.
Us. Yeah, we'll figure out a way to make that happen. And if you hear construction noises during the podcast, it's because we're working furiously on trying to finish the Lanier Learning Center for its opening. So at any rate, we're so glad that you're here. But for those who don't know who Tommy Wasserman is, who is Tommy Wasserman?
Well, I'm 53 years old, and I'm from Sweden, and I don't know if you know the geography, but I'm from the south. I grew up there, and I became a Christian when I was 16 years old. Went to church and so on, and Bible school. I was up in Örebro, another town, to go to Bible school, and they also had a seminary there. So I got curious, and I thought, one day I want to go here, and I want to become a Bible teacher. It took me into the 90s. It took me some time before eventually I actually moved there with my wife to study theology.
Well, where did you meet your wife?
In the town where I grew up.
Oh,
so
okay.
We met there. And we have three wonderful children, but they are grown up now. Yeah, we still have one, but she's moving out in August. So we're in that transition phase.
Now, you have made quite a mark in the world in your years as a text critic. And today, what we're going to be talking about is your book, To Cast the First Stone, The Transmission of a Gospel Story. This is a book that you co-authored with Jennifer Knust, right?
Yes.
How did that collaboration work?
So I want to go back to my undergraduate studies, where I, in Örebro, wrote a bachelor thesis on this little passage in John 7:53-8:11, the pericope of the adulterers. And that was a rather technical, it became an article eventually. It was an examination in 30 or so manuscripts, Greek manuscripts, which had a special variant that Jesus was writing on the ground. He was writing their sins. And when they read it, the scribes and Pharisees, they left and walked away and so on. So I had written my first article on that topic. And Jennifer was working on her project, and she had written on this passage and referred to my article. And then eventually we met at a conference, and she said she had referred to my article and so on. And I suggested that we should work together on another article on the very issue, what this gap in the text that Jesus wrote on the ground. This was a fascinating topic, a kind of a gap in the text, which was filled throughout history. What did Jesus write? So that was our first cooperation, and it went so well. It was so exciting to work together. So she invited me, because she was already working, she had this idea of a book. She invited me to become co-author of this
terrific.
Book. But we then started from scratch, and it went on for over a decade.
Well, so, this kind of book, this kind of monograph, is published by Princeton University Press, which is a very prestigious press. So that's an interesting collaboration. Did you write one section, she wrote another section, or did you write over top of each other? How did that
work? Yeah, that's interesting.
Because I've written books with
actually,
other people.
We describe a bit of that in the foreword. Yeah. We talk about this process. So most of the book, Jennifer is the native speaker, and she has a good writing style and so on. And I'm the person looking at the details very, very deeply into all kinds of details. And we were working in this way, I was doing a lot of research on the ground into manuscripts, and she was painting the wide picture, and in her very good style of writing, and I would read what and fill in a lot of footnotes, and we worked on the text together. Mm. She would give me a draft, and I sent back something, and so on.
A lot of back and forth.
Yeah.
Over 10 years to create.
Yeah,
the book.
And yeah. Some of the most fascinating when we made some discoveries. You know, I could send an email to her. Look what I found. Oh, this is fantastic. A few hours later, this is fantastic. And
you guys were like 6 hours. You're six hours ahead. So you had to kind of negotiate around the time.
I have several thousands of emails back and forth from this period.
Well, that's a good part of the history in your papers one of these days, your academic papers. Well, I'm going to look over at a New International Version, which is a very prominent translation here in the States, the NIV. And the particular pericope or story that you describe here in chapter 753 to 811, it's in italic text, first of all, this text.
In NIV?
Yeah, in the NIV. So it's in italic. So that looks different. But before that, it says this, and I'm going to read it. The earliest manuscripts and many other ancient witnesses do not have John 7:53 to 8:11. A few manuscripts include these verses wholly or in part after John 7:36, John 21:25, Luke 21:38, or Luke 24:53. And there's a hard line at the beginning and at the end of the pericope. So clearly this part, as could say, disputed text, is it original and that kind of thing. So I want to talk about that. When you guys wrote this book, what was the big idea in putting it together and in dealing with this particular text?
Well, it's a fascinating, it's one of the most beloved passages, I think, in the church, and it's known widely outside of the church, and to cast the first stone, at least in my language, in Swedish, it's proverb almost. So it's very well known, and it's a beloved story about Jesus. And yet, as you say, as you point out, it has been bracketed or treated, you know, the editors of NIV, they signal to the reader that there's something going on here. So it's missing from the earliest manuscripts and so on. And actually, I would say that there is a wide scholarly consensus that this passage was missing. It was not part of the original Gospel of John. It came into John.
So what does it mean, going back to what you said, what does it mean that it came into John? Does that mean scribes in later generations added it at this place and at these other places?
Perhaps not scribes in the plural, but at some point some editor inserted it here in this at this point. And I also want to say that just because it wasn't a part of John doesn't mean that it's not tradition about Jesus that was circulating in the early church and was viewed as gospel, so to speak. Gospel, with gospel I mean a gospel story.
And in some places it's located in Luke as in whole or in part, at least.
Yeah, that has its special explanation. That actually is related to lessons in church, because it was read together with a certain lesson from Luke. So it's a special family of manuscripts which has transposed it to a place near another passage which was read in church.
So would it be like a lectionary then?
The reason why it was transposed to that particular place is related to reading lessons in the church. So that's at the later stage. And also you mentioned, I think, or the footnote in NIV said that in some manuscripts it's placed at the end of John.
Yes.
Yes. Yeah. And that has also an explanation, which is they can't go through that in the footnote,
right.
In a note.
Right,
But
because you could do a whole article
exactly,
on that. Exactly.
Right? Yeah. We do it in our book.
Okay.
Yeah, but in that family of manuscripts, it's family one, it's called. And there is actually an explanation. It's a small ancient editorial note which says that this passage, it's not mentioned by John Chrysostom, by Cyril of Alexandria, nor by Theodore Mopsestia and the rest. And therefore, some ancient editor had pulled it out from its place, and they had placed it at the end of John. So there is a small note, actually, in the manuscripts of this family explaining, and then comes the pericope at the end of John. So actually, this placement also tells us through this note that it was taken out at some point. So it was not only inserted at some early point, but it was also in this family of manuscript taken out and placed at the end of John. So that's another development.
So when we say the earliest manuscripts, how early are we talking?
Yeah, in terms of manuscripts, we have manuscripts on papyri. We have fragmentary manuscripts, and we have more extensive. For example, we say papyri 66 and 75. Those contain a more extensive Gospel of John.
Not just a page or two.
Exactly. Right. And they're dated around the 3rd century and so on. And there is a discussion about, they don't have a date stamped on them.
Right,
but
yeah.
So this is okay. maybe
3rd century.
Yeah, they don't have the passage. And it's also very significant that the earliest, the church fathers, the authors, like Chrysostom and earlier, Origen and those.
They don't mention this.
They don't
story.
Mention this.
Yeah.
On the other hand, it turns up around 400 in Codex Besae Cantabrigiensis, a parchment manuscript, which is now in Cambridge. There is.
Oh, next time I go to Cambridge, yeah, we need to see that.
Yeah, you must have permission. Yeah, they guard it. So it's the oldest Greek manuscript that has the pericope. But there are.
But that's about 400.
Yeah.
Okay.
There are other traces earlier. For example, in the Didascalia Apostolorum in Syriac, a church order, a Christian writing from the 3rd century, it has another version, a shorter version of the story, but it's definitely the same with this climax, did they not condemn you, but there are elders this time. And it doesn't say that she had committed adultery, but she was a woman who had sinned. She has a sinning woman. And it has this climax, did they not condemn you? Jesus asks the woman and say, she says no. And neither do I condemn you, go and sin no more. So it has this.
It
has
the same pronouncement at the very ending, right?
Yeah. Yep. But it doesn't have the
casting
of the stone.
Yeah.
But this is the earliest reference, I should say. And there are other traces. It has a prehistory.
So it comes into the tradition and stays there after a while.
Yes.
People who copy this Codex Besae and others will continue to copy it and see it as part of the Gospel of John, located in the place that it is now in our modern Bibles.
Yes.
Without the italics at that point. Yeah. So to be specific here, what was Jesus writing on the ground? I mean, I've heard all sorts of sermons about
that. So we are not explaining that in our article about the topic. We are not trying to, historically speaking, reconstruct. There are some scholars who tried, but that's it's impossible to know. But
we don't know, really. But, I mean, there's been a lot of speculation.
Yes,
right?
And even in manuscripts, in illuminations, for example, in one, Codex Egberti and a few others, it's a Latin manuscript, and it has terra terram accusat, and it means earth accuses earth. So earth, we are made of earth. We're just humans.
Right.
And earth here, the scribes and the Pharisees, they are just earth. And they are accusing earth. It's a beautiful terra terram accusat. Of course, as I referred to earlier, my first article, there is a group of manuscripts which have that he wrote their sins. And when they had read what he wrote on the ground, they were struck in their conscience,
and they
left because he wrote their sins, and maybe that inspiration from a passage in Jeremiah.
So we don't know exactly where that came from, do we?
No, but it's a fascinating gap in the text, so to speak, which was filled in different ways throughout history.
You're doing a Bible translation, as I understand it, in Swedish, right?
Oh, yeah. Now we are revising because it will be 500 years since our first Bible translation came out 1526. So now I'm a consultant for these kinds of issues, like manuscript issues for this new translation.
So what is your advice to them regarding this passage? How is that passage going to be represented in the new translation?
That will not be very different. It will be still, I think, in brackets and with a note, a footnote, explaining, giving some basic explanation.
So if a minister would come to you and say, I would like to preach on this passage, is it really in the Bible? That's kind of a simple question, I know, but how would you advise them?
Yeah, it has been in Bibles since Codex Besae, since the time. And that church, around 400, had it at its traditional place. and they preached it. And eventually it was also read in liturgy at times. So it's part of our tradition, and it was regarded as gospel, so to speak, for early Christians. So I would encourage them, you can preach. But at the same time, it's good to be aware, perhaps, that it was not the author of the fourth gospel who penned it.
Does it sound like John? I mean, you know, as you read the rest of the gospel, does this sort of read in the Greek like John, or does it have that sort of sound? Could it be part of a Johannine school, which is always...
those are interesting questions. Yeah, it fits rather well also at this point in the text concerning the law. There has been a discussion with the Jewish leaders and so on. So it fits rather well also here. There are some unique vocabulary and so on, but it fits rather well at this place.
And people have sometimes asked me, and I don't know that I have a good answer for this, but when somebody talks about a gospel being published, they use that kind of term, or it's not published in the way a modern book is published.
No.
I'm not even sure there was the right term for that. Maybe you have a better term in Swedish than we have to talk about when a gospel is written and then it begins to be dispatched and circulated.
Yeah.
I don't know.
No, that's right. And you can see also traces of this in John, at the end of John. You have a conclusion in actually chapters 20, and then you have a second kind. It looks like a second conclusion, 21, and it seems like maybe that disciple had died, maybe, because someone else is talking in chapter 21, and we know that his testimony is true.
Right.
We know. What is this group? We?
Yeah,
it seems to be maybe disciples of John who made short to put in circulation the gospel, perhaps after his death.
After his death, and to put in circulation. We've been talking to Dr. Tommy Wasserman about his book, To Cast the First Stone, The Transmission of a Gospel Story. Fascinating book, a good book, a book of great detail, but also, I think, beautifully written. Thanks for being with us today on The Stone Chapel.
It was my pleasure. Thank you.
We ended that podcast too soon, didn't we? I know. Let me console you. A nugget of wisdom is coming your way from our guest in just a moment. Thanks to our production staff, headed by Kathy Capes. Thanks to Phil Keggy for our music. Now hit that subscribe button at this moment, at this very moment, on your favorite platform to keep the Stone Chapel podcast coming your way. If you like the podcast, there's something else you can do for us, and that is to rate it right now and leave comments, tell your friends. If you have questions for our experts, comments, or just want to be in touch, here's how. Email us at podcast@lanierlibrary.org. podcast@lanierlibrary.org. Now, Lanier is spelled L-A-N-I-E-R. We'd love to hear from you. My name is David Capes, and this is the Stone Chapel Podcast from the Lanier Theological Library in Houston. Thanks for listening.
I want to go to a passage in Romans 8:28, because my daughter, she actually preached for the first time last Sunday in our church. And this was in her text in Romans 8:28. We know that all things work together for good for those who love God, who are called according to his purpose. And in her sermon, she also had an illustration from the life of Joseph. We know the story of Joseph. There was many bad things happened to Joseph, and his brothers were involved. Towards the end of that particular story, there is reconciliation between Joseph and his brothers who had treated him ill. He says to them that you had bad plans for me, but God has used it to your good. So that illustrates the whole story about Joseph and his brothers and his father and all the mistakes Joseph himself made by bragging. He was a favorite child and so on. And all the bad things, he was sold as a slave. He came to prison and God used it for the good, even the good of his brothers who had treated him so badly. And he could see this, that he could now help them. He had bread when they needed. They were all taught a lesson. And my daughter talked about us today being in this in this great plan of God, and sometimes we don't understand what is happening. We're like sitting in the darkness, and we can't see the next step. We can't see any future. But when we look at our lives backwards, so to speak, perhaps we can see then that everything has worked to the good, and God has used even negative things for something good.